Thank you for coming. This is the fifth and final session of a class that I have been doing this week called Enhancing or Strengthening Our Capacity for Ministry. And we've looked primarily at Matthew 18 as a guide to keep us moving in the right direction as we think about challenging relationships. And so we're going to recapitulate that a little bit today, but mostly today I want to talk about how anxiety gets in the way, both for us individually and in our congregations or our organizations. I'm Reverend John Beck from Portland, Oregon. I pastor St. Timothy Lutheran Church for the last 10 years, and my background in that congregation has involved working with some conflict because they had had 10 pastors in 10 years before I came. So now I'm called the permanent pastor. But let's begin with a word of prayer. Gracious One, we thank you for this day. We thank you for this place, a place of rest and renewal and relearning for many of us. Thank you for those who have joined the village, and we pray for those who are departing today. Continue to weave us together in your body so that we can be kingdom people, bringing a good word to our world. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Did you all get copies of these sheets? I also want to just reference briefly, some of you were interested, there is a copy of the covenant that a congregation sent in just this week that they used based on this work. And there's also, I mentioned, as we talked about forgiveness yesterday, our bishop sends out a weekly little newsletter. And this came yesterday from our assistant bishop. It's a list from Sister Joan Spearing, a sister of the Holy Child Jesus congregation in Philadelphia. This is a sister who also taught at a college in Portland, has been a counselor and a member of a joint ELCA and Roman Catholic parish, the Mission of Atonement. They share space together. And they do everything except have communion together. And there's a nice list, kind of David Letterman, well, not quite David Letterman-like, about what forgiveness is not and what forgiveness is. And since we were doing this yesterday, I think I'll just share it with you. Forgiveness is not forgetting. Forgiveness is not excusing. Forgiveness is not the same as smothering conflict. Accepting people is not forgiving them. Forgiving is not tolerance. Forgiveness is not absolution. Forgiveness is not a form of self-sacrifice. Forgiveness is not a clear-cut, one-time decision. Forgiveness is a byproduct of an ongoing healing process. Forgiveness is an internal process. Forgiveness is a sign of positive self-esteem. Forgiveness is letting go of the intense emotions attached to incidents from our past. Forgiveness is recognizing that we no longer need our grudges and resentments, our hatred and self-pity. Forgiveness is no longer wanting to punish the people who hurt us. Forgiveness is accepting that nothing we do to punish them will heal us. Forgiveness is freeing up and putting to better use the energy once consumed by holding grudges, harboring resentments, and nursing unhealed wounds. Forgiveness is moving on. So there's a few copies of Sister Joan Spearing's list about forgiveness. For those of you who are coming here for the first time, Matthew 18, 15 to 20 invites us to go directly to one another when there's a difficulty. And if that doesn't work, then we have some other steps. But the hope is that it will work, And so when we go in good faith and have a conversation where we're clear about our needs and limits and are curious to try to find out someone else's needs and limits, then the hope is that that will lead us to step five, to the reconciliation. But if that doesn't work, we're invited to get someone to go along who is not going to just be our advocate, but is going to be a wise person who can help us get to that good faith conversation. And if that doesn't work, we get the whole church involved to try to bring pressure to bear to get us to have the conversation that we need to have. And if even that doesn't work, Jesus suggests that we treat the person who won't play nicely as a tax collector and a sinner. But we know that Jesus reached out to tax collectors and sinners, so even that as a kind of a double message. The church has used this step to demote and remove people from the fellowship. But the whole passage is really about reconciliation. And we're clear about that because right before this, Jesus talks about the importance of seeking the one, leaving the 99, and to go out and find the lost. And right after this, the text for this Sunday, we hear about how many times we are to forgive. So this is all about forgiveness. And the promise that Christ gives to be with us doesn't mean that we have to get it together before we can experience Christ's presence. That in fact, in the midst of the mess, in the midst of the confusion, in the midst of the hurt and the anger, Christ is present. And so we're drawing on that this week in a number of different directions. One of the things that is very clear and that we talked about a little bit is the whole notion of what it takes to be able to go. And if you're anything like me, that's the hardest step. Finding the courage to actually get myself moving in someone else's direction. And that's why we want to talk about anxiety a little bit today, and why I've given you a sheet that has these graphics on it, important questions for leaders to ponder. We're going to work through this sheet a little bit, and I want to hit a few of the highlights that I see underneath this as we have this conversation. When we talked about leadership behavior, we were really, and we talked about how we want to make agreements about how we're going to talk to one another, how we're going to interact. Remember, we did the respect guidelines? See if you can remember any of them. Take responsibility, what you say, and think before you speak. Oh, no, so that you don't blame others. Use empathetic listening. S, be sensitive.
Different communication styles.
Here's the one. Ponder before you speak. And then be willing to examine your assumptions and perception. Keep confidentiality and trust and tolerate ambiguity, because we're not here to debate who is right or wrong. Now, part of what an agreement like this does is it gives us some boundaries so we know when a ball is in fair play and when it's out of bounds. And one of the things that is so hard for human beings is to be able to determine where the ball is. And what do I mean by that? What happens when anxiety goes up for us? And anxiety can either be what's going on inside of us, or anxiety can be because of something that's coming at us. Now, we were in a Feldenkrais class 2 days ago, and Suddenly, someone screamed very loudly, right behind me. And I had a huge rush of adrenaline. Well, that's because we are built to be able to have quick responses. And what are the three? Fight?
Flight.
Flight? Or freeze? Now, I didn't decide to jump when this lady screamed. And she didn't decide to scream when the chipmunk ran through.
No.
About that far from her head. Remember when the mouse ran through Aaron's hair?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it was, those are scary times. And what happens is that we have an autonomic nervous system that is always engaged. We are not sitting here saying, I think I'll inhale, I think I'll exhale. There are lots of people who can slow their heartbeats down after years of meditation, but we don't decide, today I think I want my heart to beat. It just beats. And that's because there's part of our brain that is engaged to keep us as an individual and as a species alive. And that part of the brain, and I am a really awful artist, but that part of the brain is this part, the lower part, the brainstem, and we refer to it lovingly as the reptilian brain. It's the oldest part of the brain. It's the fastest part of the brain. There wasn't, I mean, it was just a hundredth of a second, a Michael Phelps kind of part of a second, and I jumped, and my heart started racing when I heard that scream. So this is very fast, and it keeps us alive. It keeps our heart beating, our lungs, and it determines when there's a threat. So there's a part of us that is doing constant threat assessments. Is this bear that is walking down the trail towards us a real threat? Is it like someone was alleging at the beginning of the week? You know, are there grizzlies here? Well, you know, there's a different kind of threat assessment if we're thinking, oh, this might be that once in 50 years when there's actually a grizzly here, as opposed to the other bears that are easier to blow your whistle at. I don't know if you can blow whistles at grizzlies. So, this part of the brain is very fast. Another part of the brain that's called the limbic system has the capacity for bonding and connection. It's the part of the brain where the feeling centers reside. And it allows us to have feelings and to love and care and all those altruistic things. But there's also another part of the brain that is called the neocortex. And this is very simplistic, but the thinking brain and the feeling brain and the reptilian brain. The thinking brain has the potential, but only the potential, to regulate the other parts of the brain. In other words, and the story I love is the story about one of the great psychology gurus who was developing science earlier in the century. And he would put in his lab, he had a puff adder, one of the most poisonous snakes on the planet, if not the most poisonous. And that snake was in a glass cage. And I think this was Skinner. Skinner would crawl towards the cage, and the snake would get ready and then would strike. And he crawled toward the cage to see if when the snake struck, if he was able to not have a startle response. So what do you think? He did it hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times. Was he ever able to overcome his startle response? No, he wasn't. That's the same part of the brain that kicked in when I heard the scream. That's the same part of the brain that is engaged when I get pissed off. All right? When I get highly anxious. And here's the trickiest part. When we have a reptilian response, our thinking brain is generating a narrative that helps us make sense of what it is that we're experiencing. And this narrative serves our best interest. Now, it's a logical narrative, but it may be very inaccurate, which is part of the reason why feelings are really important to be aware of, but they're not always trustworthy. And I wish I'd learned that a lot earlier in life. Because remember, there was such an emphasis on getting in touch with your feelings. Well, and then that's good. But knowing your feelings is very different than how you're going to evaluate them and what you're going to do with them. So, when it comes to being able to recognize when we're in fight, flight, or freeze mode, it's very important to have some kind of handles on this. And that's what we're inviting in this first part of the sheet. Because right at the top, we're acknowledging when we ask the question, what was your functional position in your family of origin? We're acknowledging that a lot of the patterns that come for us are autopilots, are formed in deeply profound ways in our families. And so my family taught me, without even trying, to be a really good, helpful boy. And the minute Joan needs something, this is my wife Joan, I am most comfortable and happy if I can immediately attend to her and take care of whatever it is. Yeah, it's a good deal for her.
But is it true?
But is it true? Yeah, that's we can talk amongst ourselves later. But for the point here, I'm just saying that that's the way my wiring goes. Now, in my family, silence was not a comfortable thing. And we didn't have much silence. And so yesterday when we did the exercise where you, for those of you that were here, were drawing little sketches about an incident from your childhood or in your family, I said, okay, I'll give you about 10 minutes to do this kind of reflection and do a little drawing. Now, what was happening to my anxiety as I tried to give you that instruction? And then, as I tried to sit calmly, letting this silence, my anxiety was going up and up and up. And how long could I stand it? How long, did any of you know how long we actually?
It wasn't 10 minutes.
It wasn't 10, thank you. It was about 7 minutes. I couldn't stand it. And then, I said, it looks like most of you are done. You know, so I had a narrative going that was helping me explain what I was doing. But it was a narrative that I learned in my family of origin. Unfortunately, most of the time, those patterns that we get into function a little bit outside of consciousness. Now, it could be that you've done some work or had some good feedback and you know some of yours. But a lot of us, kind of right on the edge of consciousness in terms of why we're doing stuff. Well, a lot of it has to do with our family and those early years. So What were some of the roles that you had in your family? Typically, things like a rebel or a good kid or the princess or
protector.
Huh?
Protector.
Protector? Uh-huh.
Peacemaker.
Peacemaker.
Responsible.
The responsible one.
Caretaker.
Caretaker? No rebels?
They're all out hiking.
They're all out hiking. Yeah. That's right. That's right. Well, that's one of the ways to consider what your functional position was. Because we know that sibling order says a lot about how we're gonna develop. And there's some similarities if you took 100 firstborns or 100 oldests and compared them with 100 middles or 100 youngests. There are some things that those folks all have in common. Now, you know, there's always going to be some outliers, but mostly we know that those patterns are powerful. And when we're thinking about the functional position that we have in our family, there's an awful lot of us who find it, well, I don't know if it's surprising or not, but we often end up in work where we are able to continue the functional position that we had in our family, in our jobs. So I happen to be a pastor who has a first impulse of being a caretaker. And so it's harder work for me to help people be independent. I have to work at not creating dependencies, because I love to take care of people so much. But that's the way my family worked. And my mom is going to be 94, and I'm still taking care of her. She set this all up so that I would be able to be a good son all her life. And she has those genes, those Wisconsin Norwegian genes. She has aunts that died at 104 and 101, and she's now pushing 94. So the middle question, when things start to shake, which is what Don's going to talk about after supper, how do you know not when there is an earthquake, but how do you know when you are anxious? Do you know what the physiological markers are in your body, in your psyche? How do you know?
I feel like there's a buzzing inside me.
A buzzing in whereabouts?
Like in my head.
Okay.
Or in my arms, my hands. I feel like the blood pressure is up, I think, is probably what it is.
Okay.
I can also feel my heart rate go up.
Okay. What other physiological signals does your body give you?
Pain in the neck.
A pain in the neck. Yeah, that's people responding to you, or that's you. No, I'm sorry.
Muscles tensing.
Muscles tensing? A lot of people have that. My palms will sweat. I have a really good friend who flushes. She just gets bright red when she gets aggravated. Some people respond that they notice their breath gets shallow. When I get anxious, if I have a pen in my hand, I'm starting to do the pen clicking thing. When we're in meetings together, Joan will take out her pen and start to do the same thing to tell me to cool it. There are not only the physiological responses that our body has to tell us what's going on, but there's also sequences that we can learn about that help us recognize what the dance is like. So, for example, what kind of tone of voice can you use that will evoke a rather major reptilian response from me?
Yeah, you think it sounds critical.
I perceive, it may not be, but I perceive in a certain kind of tone that I'm being criticized. And in my family, I came out of my family ill prepared to deal with criticism because I was such a star and so wonderful. I have great star muscles. I have poor muscles at getting in trouble. So I'm gradually learning, and we've been married, we're in our 11th year now, aren't we?
12th. Our 12th. We came to 11, yeah.
Yeah, so we were married in 97. So I'm gradually learning that when I think that I hear that tone, I have to try to stop this and ask the question. But there's a sequence that goes on because once I've had my reactive moment, I rarely de-escalate. It tends to kind of ramp up. So there are steps for most of us that exacerbate the already present anxiety when we have a moment, when our button gets pushed. Are you aware of any of the sequences for you that get you going?
When you talk about anxious, to me anxious is when your child is not home at 2 in the morning and you're wondering where and what. Now that to me is anxious.
No.
Not anything else.
The one of the times when you really can recognize that you're anxious is when a situation like a kid being gone in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how would you describe lesser, I mean, experiences that are kind of not that harsh? Just kind of frustrating.
I know there was pretty good kids.
I'm a lousy waiter. When I set some time, or somebody set some time, and I expect to be there, or I expect somebody to be there, and the time goes by, and after 5 minutes,
Wondering
what's going on.
You betcha.
On field trips, he didn't wait 5 minutes. You were there at 6 o'clock in the morning, and if you weren't there, the bus left.
Yeah. Well, the sequence that leads up to getting your button pushed or having your frustration go up so that it's noticeable for you, all I'm saying here is that there is a sequence. And to the extent to which you can recognize the steps, then you may be able to choose more how you respond. A guy named Murray Bowen hypothesized that the self, that the self could be more or less differentiated. And that's one of those highfalutin psychology terms that most psychologists will not agree about, so there's a lot of different terms, but Bowen had a scale from 0 to 100 where he hypothesized that some people are going to have more of a sense of self and some are going to have less. And this sense of self has to do with your capacity to function on the basis of your ideas and your beliefs, as opposed to what he called the emotional functioning that goes on whenever people are together. And so when someone, because they are uncomfortable, gives up self and accommodates, Bowen would say they're functioning at a lower level of differentiation. So another way that some people talk about differentiation is to talk about emotional maturity. And Bowen hypothesized that probably no one functions above 70. They're rare people. Maybe, you know, Jesus and Gandhi. I don't know how you spell Gandhi. Martin Luther, you know, some of our heroes function at a higher level. Most of us are probably below 50. And in fact, if, you know, this would probably be the area where most of us kind of live. People have differentiation that is similar to that of their parents. So the apple doesn't fall from the tree. If my dad was a 30, then I'm probably not going to be more than a 35 or less than a 25. And he also hypothesized that there would be a basic level of differentiation and a functional level. And that means that if I was a 25, that it could be that because of training or therapy or good coaching or real interesting experiences, that I might be able to raise my functional level quite a bit. So that in the world I'm perceived as highly professional or effective. Now, I have a friend whose father was a very effective professional, but when he came home, his functional level dropped down. He was very verbally abusive, he could be violent. That never was seen outside the home. So the functional level can be higher or lower than the basic level. And this scale also suggests that people marry someone that is similarly differentiated to themselves. So, I think Joan's much more differentiated than I am, so I'm really excited to be married to her, but you see, she's shaking her head. She thinks she's probably not as differentiated as I would say she is. The notion here is that the farther down the scale you are, the easier it is for you to be clicked into automatic processes. Into processes that are unthinking, that are in this fight, flight, freeze kind of pattern. And that often one of the typical kinds is over-functioning and under-functioning. And those go together. You can't have an over-functioner unless you have people that are willing to under-function and vice versa. And so when people get caught into those kinds of reciprocal patterns, they happen almost like an autopilot. And when you're working with a couple where there's an over and an under-functioner, sometimes simply pointing out the pattern is enough for them to step back and go, So pattern recognition is very important. A student of Bowen's named Edwin Friedman gave, I think, a helpful description of what it means to be a healthy self. And at the bottom of that sheet, you'll find that he thinks that it has to do with having boundaries, being able to, what's the language that's used here?
Calm and anxiety.
Yeah. To be able to stay calm in the middle of anxiety, to be able to self-regulate. And to be able to have goals and a direction. Now, boundaries are about where I start and stop. And have you ever known someone who didn't have any boundaries, and just bear with me, and when he talked to you, he was about this close to you?
Oh, yeah.
You know, there is about 18 to 24 inches is, I think, the standard interaction space when people are dialoguing. And if you're trying to talk to someone, you know, and so when I met you today, we were standing talking, if I had just started to kind of slide away like this, it would have seemed just as weird as if I had gotten closer. Well, those are physical boundaries, but there's also emotional boundaries in terms of how intrusive someone is or isn't. And knowing where I start or stop is an important aspect of boundaries. Staying calm amidst anxiety is hard work because anxiety is contagious. Can you think of someone when they walk into the room, the anxiety just goes up? They tend to have a way to whip up people's emotion. And I can tell you exactly what's going to happen when a certain person comes to a church council meeting. Because she's not going to come unless she's worked up. And when she's worked up, I can guarantee that the council has to really, really work to not just get caught up in the emotionality that she brings. And I think I'm good at this stuff, and I participate. I mean, we want to keep her happy. And so, doggone it, we've gone along with stuff that was just idiotic. Which is why, in a highly emotional state, you don't want to make any major long-term decisions. When someone is in the midst of grief, you know, they're advised, don't make a quick decision. Well, it has to do with this business about how your thinking brain does or doesn't work. Some of you were here the first day on Monday, and I invited people to learn this little respect guideline. And I said, let's see, R stands for, and I absolutely went blank. I mean, I couldn't. And then I tried to dump it off on Joan. Joan, what is that? You know, as though she was supposed to. Well, my brain, I wanted it to appear that I was calm. But what was going on was my reptilian brain was firing. I was in save my life mode. And I could not think. My mind went absolutely blank. Now, people that do a lot of public presentation learn tricks so that they're able to stay calm and have access to their full brain. I don't have full access to my whole brain. Self-regulation is not about whether Metamucil is needed on this particular day. Self-regulation has to do with whether we can make a decision and then act on it, whether we can follow through with it. Make decisions, keep commitments, and finally, being able to be clear about goals. Seneca, the ancient, I think he was Roman, had a statement that I love. A sailor without a destination cannot tell a good wind from an ill wind. I just love that. And I don't know if I've added this to it or someone else, but if a sailor without a destination cannot tell a good wind from an ill wind, then we're more likely to end up in someone else's storm. Because whatever whirlwind blows through is going to get you. So with these notions as a guide, I encourage and invite you to use this or share this, because leaders in the church need to have tools that help them stay on track. And first, are there any questions about this system stuff and the role that anxiety plays? Yeah.
I thought Anne raised a question of how you would define anxiety that you didn't answer.
Well, the word comes from an Anglo-Saxon word that means to strangle or to squeeze. And when we feel that kind of pressure, whether from inside or from the outside, we don't have as full access to our coping skills as we might like. So anxiety is a kind of a way that we get squeezed. Does that make sense?
Are we, like, perceiving a threat? Or we're guessing that a threat, we're acting as if a threat is there?
Well, you know, there's two kinds of threat. There's perceived and there's real threat. And it can be either that can cause our anxiety to go up.
Where does worry, just plain out worrying, fit in all this?
Well, I think that there's certainly a similarity between worry and anxiety.
Yeah.
Worry, for me, tends to be a little bit more internal, and I might be manifesting a sign of worry. Usually when someone is anxious, there's going to be some, it's going to show somehow. Someone might be worried but not show it.
But it's certainly not productive.
I could argue that it was the worry that got some of my papers written in college.
Or the threat of something else.
Yeah, I mean, there was the threat of consequences.
Yeah.
And the distinction between worry and anxiety, anxiety can be passed on. I mean, so can worry, but anxiety has more to do with what's going on both in me and how I'm connecting with other people. Worry may be a little bit more of a narrow notion. Anxiety I can pass on pretty easily.
I mean, you've got me thinking of a skunk or an octopus or something like that. You touch them, the ink cloud goes out whether it needs to or not. So somehow anxiety is like the ink cloud or the, I don't know. Does that help?
Well, and, you know, we tend to talk about anxiety in terms of whether someone is an amplifier of anxiety or whether they help turn down the volume. There are some people, when they walk into the room, and their calm presence just gives everybody confidence that it's going to be okay. We want leaders who have and are able to be calm presence for us. One of the people that I think of in my life who was such a presence was a guy named Ray Johnson, who was the head of the youth department of the old ALC for many years. And there were 26,000 high school kids running around the Louisiana Superdome. And those of us that were on staff for that event were pretty worried about lots of stuff. And when Ray would come and walk through and have a word with you, you know, the whole world was back on course again. So, I don't know if that clarifies. I want to give you something that's a little bit outside the bounds of what we're talking about. But one of the things that raises anxiety a lot for most of us, especially in the church, is change.
Oh, yes.
And change is something that pastors have been trying to figure out how to cope with forever, but especially the last couple decades as the world has changed so much. And I have found that the distinction that a guy named Ron Heifetz makes between technical change and adaptive change is one of the most helpful distinctions that I have come across. And that's what the second sheet is. It's kind of a summary of some of the main points of his book, through the eyes of Sharon Dallas Parks, who wrote a book about his thinking. And technical change and adaptive change are the two kinds of change that can often get confused. So, if we just look at this from the perspective of who is doing the work, or what is the work? What work? And who does it? that can give us a little handle on this. My church, the offering plates need to get from the counting room back to the narthex before the offering. And on Sunday after church, I don't know who actually brings them. They bring them forward, and then the counting secretary picks up the plates and takes them in and takes care of them. And then they either end up in the safe, or on top of the safe, or on a counter in that workroom. Now, we've got some new ushers, and those new ushers have not all been oriented properly, and about 3 months ago, Don Weber, you can see the ushers through the glass, and Don Weber, I started to notice him walking back and forth, and he's kind of bending over, and I'm going, I know what's going on. He can't find the offering plates, and it's getting closer and closer and closer. And so at some point, he comes down the side aisle, and being the wizard that I am, I simply walked down and met him and said, ask Gene Whitford, which I thought was pretty cool. And he went and got Gene Whitford, because she has the combination to the safe, and they, you know. Well, this was a technical issue. It was a technical challenge. There were people such as myself. The work has to do with who knows what. It has to do with knowledge that we have. And it's just a matter of applying it. And who does that? Well, the leader. Adaptive challenges are not like technical challenges. In my congregation, we have the great gift of some ethnic diversity, and we have several families of Pacific Island folks from Samoa. Some brothers from Micronesia have married sisters from Samoa, two of them. And there's a clan, and they're just a great gift to us. And now in these last 6 or 7 years, we have been talking about how we're going to develop more and more relationships across some of the dividing lines. We have between 5 and 10 folks with mental and physical challenges who are part of our worshiping community. We have this group of Samoan folks. And as a congregation, we share space and rent to a Ukrainian Pentecostal church and an Adventist group of folks from, they're based in New Zealand, but they're Samoan people. So there's Samoan Adventists. So there's a lot of diversity. And so we've been talking about how we can cross some of these boundaries and how we can develop relationships. And we've actually had several approaches where we've actually, you know, we're going to try to do this, we're going to try to do this. Nothing seems to work. So far, I'm the only person in the congregation that I'm aware of that has had any of the Samoan folks in our home or who have shared a meal. Now, the Samoan folks are great at having big festivals and inviting the whole congregation, but we haven't figured out how to develop relationships with these families. Now, that's an adaptive problem. That's a problem that requires adaptation, and the work is to learn new ways. But neither the leader nor the people know how to do it. But who does it? The people with the problem. And so I might have lots of ideas about how we're going to solve this adaptive issue, but I really, you know, I can't force it to happen. And in these situations, what tends to happen is we tend to try to apply technical solutions to adaptive problems. And that gets us again and again and again. We try to solve adaptive problems by suggesting technical solutions. And then we'll try another technical solution, and then another technical solution, and pretty soon we just don't understand what's going on. So Heifetz, in his work, says that the way we have to be able to deal with that is to recognize a couple things. First, we need to recognize that change requires incredible grief. It brings so much grief and so much unrecognized grief that when people are resistant to change, part of it has to do with the loss that they're experiencing. And so when people are change bringers, they need to recognize that it's a normal thing for, at the bottom on that, on page 7, point C, leaders who try to bring change are going to be marginalized and attacked and distracted and seduced. That that's just a normal thing that's going to happen. And if we're not clear that that's going to happen, then we're setting ourselves up for failure. Ron, in your pastorates, you may have experienced that you had a good idea and people just weren't ready to jump on board. And it's awful easy for us to take that personally. And for way too long, when people wouldn't accept my influence, I just said, oh, gosh, well. And I felt wounded and hurt, crawl back into my little hole and come out later. But, you know, from a sports perspective, if I'm running down the field and I've got the soccer ball and I'm getting close to the goal and I get ready to kick and someone tackles me, I don't pout about it. I get up and I go try to get the ball back. And we have to have that kind of capacity to deal with some of these challenges that are coming to us. And so Heifetz suggests that in order to do that, the best way, the one he suggests, is to have the flexibility to go up onto the balcony and watch what's going on the dance floor. And then to get back down on the dance floor and do an intervention, do something. And then get back up on the balcony and see what happened. And to be leaders involved in change, we need to be in both places almost simultaneously. And that's been a very helpful image for me as I try to figure out how to deal with adaptation. I'll close with a story about Phil Jackson, who is one of my favorite strange coaches. When he was coaching the Chicago Bulls and they were getting close to their big run when they won, was it 5 or 6 in a row? There was a famous game when, with 5 seconds to go, there's a timeout and he called somebody's number to take a shot, and it wasn't Scottie Pippen. And Scottie got so mad that he threw down his towel and walked off, took himself out. Well, I can't remember if the Bulls won the game or not. But in the locker room after the game, Jackson walks into the locker room and says to the team, I guess you've got some things to work out, don't you? And goes into his office. And it's a wonderful example of one of the principles that Heifetz talks about, which is giving the work back to the people rather than taking it on yourself. Jackson could have thought that that was his issue, but in some ways it was really a team issue and they needed to figure it out. And I have been aided tremendously by that kind of thinking, because a lot of times we have to figure out what's really our work and what's the group's work. So as you think about change, and about what it means to be a healthy, as mature as we can be self, I pray that you will use Matthew 18 as you are able, go directly, and experience the blessings that come from practicing that kind of shalom work. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think Lee is coming in very soon to try again.
Well, he's all hooked up anyway.
He's all hooked up.
We started at 3:45.
Yep.
Agreement.
How you doing?
You know, I just get a little better and a little better and a little better and a little better. It just takes a long time for those chalk particles to where they are to settle down.
Crystal.
Yeah.
Can I do something?
No, I think I have to go over and buy those shirts.
Buy the shirts?
Oh, yeah.
You want help?
Yeah.
Okay. Hey!
Thank you.
Very well.
I did my internship in Papua New Guinea.
Yeah.
And they use a consensus method of, they were deciding things.
Yeah.
And I smoked at that time. I was smoking those Australian cigarettes and went, and we could smoke in the council room.
Yeah.
But, you know, it took a long time. But when they were done,
Then it was
everybody was either on board or you canned it.
Yeah.
You know, and it was their work.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And somehow there was something really healthy about that.
Yeah. Well, there's a process that I've learned. They call it the Samoan Circle, where people come and sit in a circle and do their grievance work with one another.
I don't.
While everyone witnesses them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do.